Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. After facing mounting pressure from fans on social media, R&B star Lauryn Hill announced on May 5th that she was canceling her upcoming concert in Israel. On her website, she stated that she wanted to be a presence supporting justice and peace, but because she was unable to organize a similar concert in the occupied Palestinian territories, she canceled her Israeli appearance. While she didn't explicitly state support for the burgeoning boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, Hill is one of a growing number of artists respecting a cultural boycott of Israel over its treatment of Palestinians. But the increasing absence of art and music in Israel as a political act stands out in stark contrast to the blossoming of music in the occupied territories, particularly among young Palestinians. The story of how that is happening is told in a new book by Sandy Tolan, a journalist and documentary radio producer who teaches at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at USC. In Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land, he introduces readers to Ramzi Hussein Abu Radwan, a Palestinian composer and educator whose journey took him from Palestinian refugee camps to an international education in music after he discovered the viola as a young man. Years later, he founded several music schools in the West Bank and Palestinian refugee camps. Sandy Tolan is a radio documentary producer who's created dozens of pieces for NPR and PRI. He's a co-founder of Homelands Productions, author of The Lemon Tree and Hank and Me. He's currently an associate professor at the Annenberg School for Communications and Journalism at USC. And his new book is out right now, and he now joins me in studio to talk about it. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be here, Sonali. Thank you.
First, let's start with Ramzi Abu Radwan. He's the guy who, as a child, was photographed throwing a stone at presumably an Israeli soldier. He was 8 years old. And in many ways, even at that young age, he became a symbol, a very different symbol to what he is today. He put down the stone eventually and picked up a viola. But tell us who he was as a child, what his background was.
Well, he grew up in Al Amri refugee camp, which is just adjacent to Ramallah. It was founded after the Palestinian Nakba, or catastrophe, the event that historians call the First Arab-Israeli War, Israelis call the War of Independence. During that war, 750,000 Palestinians either fled or were driven out, including Ramzi's grandparents. They were from a little village called Na'ni, which no longer exists, along with hundreds of other Palestinian villages that are gone now. They've been destroyed, mostly by Israel. And during that time, in 48, when his grandparents went on their journey during the Nakba, they came to Al Amri and began living there. And Ramzi grew up with his impoverished grandparents. He helped his grandfather sweep the streets. His grandfather was a street sweeper in Ramallah, and learned all about Palestine. And when the first Intifada started in late 1987, it was the kids, the Atfal al-Hijra in Arabic, the children of the stones, who were really on the front lines. So kids like Ramzi at age 8 years old, the photograph you mentioned, he became very famous, much like the Tiananmen Square young man in front of the tank. It was a very iconic photo of this kid who really, along with thousands of other kids, were trying to expel Israel from the military occupation, which unfortunately goes on to this day, 48 years after the Six-Day War of 67.
So just incredible to think about what this young man went through. But of course, his story is quite typical, right? And the way in which you've described it, I mean, to think about what children go through, Palestinian children go through. I have to say, the descriptions in your book of being, you know, feeling abandoned by his mother at such a young age, being ripped from his, the life that he knew, it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah, I mean, there are people all over the world who've lost a lot, but I don't recall ever meeting someone who's lost so much. Father murdered, brother murdered. He saw a 9-year-old or maybe 12-year-old girl who he had kind of had a crush on in grade school, shot in the head by an Israeli soldier during the Intifada, the first Intifada. She died 6 days later. And so you'd think a kid like this, you know, living in a refugee camp, his grandparents were poor, really raised without significant presence of either parent, for him to remake his life You know, he was very typical of these kids, this generation of the Children of the Stones, in a sense, a lost generation. Israel closed schools, universities, even kindergartens during the First Intifada. Months at a time, schools were closed. So he managed to get an education, and then he had the opportunity to learn music later on.
So he essentially left his life in the Palestinian territories and for the first time stepped onto Western soil in, of all places, New Hampshire?
Yeah.
As a young man, where he was attending this music camp. And this was an incredible change and chapter in his life, to going on to where he went on to really become adept at music. And I love how you describe that he was amazed that everybody at that camp read the same language, and that was the language of music.
Yeah, he actually told me that when he first went there, he had never known anything but occupation, as most of the children in the West Bank and Gaza, even though Israel isn't present in the camps themselves. I mean, it's
not
present
today,
from the air. Yeah, not today, but it was at the time, and of course by air and sea, they're still unfortunately very... they're very much there now. It's an occupation by air and sea, essentially. But in any case, back then, Ramzi really didn't know anything but occupation. And he, when he got this opportunity to get a fellowship, it was during this sort of more hopeful time for many people of the Oslo era. It was before the flaws of Oslo had been as universally exposed as they are now. And many people thought this was going to lead to an independent Palestinian state. And Ramzi, in a sense, was the embodiment of many of those hopes. And so he went to New Hampshire thinking that it would be like all the other places he'd seen on television and that America represented to him, which was there'd be skyscrapers everywhere. And he went to this rural place in this leafy chamber music camp in New Hampshire and learned Mozart. And right, the first rehearsal, he looked around and said, "Wait a minute, this guy is Chinese, and this kid's Israeli, and this one's American, and they're all looking at the same music." He thought that his music was somehow Arabic music.
Mm. Now, he went on then to found a series of schools in the Palestinian territories and also in Palestinian refugee camps. And you start out in your book saying that he had told you that this was his dream
When
he was much younger. And years later, I mean, not many of us can say that we really fulfilled the dream that we explicitly set out for ourselves. How did he go about fulfilling that dream, and what has he accomplished today?
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the interesting ways to look at it, I mean, if some people, when they see, oh, it's so nice that he's put down the stone and he's picked up a viola, and he would say, I just literally changed the instruments of my resistance to the occupation. He sees music as a force of resistance, and we can talk more about
yeah.
that. But what he, when I first met him, it was in 98, during this more hopeful time when people thought the two-state solution was actually going to be possible. He, at that time, when I did a long piece about him for NPR, and he said, you know what I want to do? I want to open up music schools for the children of Palestine. He was 18 years old, living with his impoverished grandparents in the refugee camp then. Then he got an opportunity to study in France, and he kept his focus. He always wanted to do that. Meantime, I lost touch with him for probably 10 years and ran into him quite by mistake, by chance, at an Italian restaurant in Ramallah. And I said, Ramzi, what are you doing now? He said, oh, well, I'm opening up music schools for the children of Palestine. He always kept his focus. And it wasn't so much that he just wanted, you know, it's not like a kumbaya moment where suddenly you have this piece of, I mean, it is a nonviolent way of dealing with the occupation, but it's for Ramzi, it's about protecting the children with music so that they can cope with the day-to-day reality of the occupation, which is for many people in America, really off the radar screen.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you brought that up because, you know, of course, on the surface of it, for people who do know what's happening in the occupied territories, to focus on music education while Gaza gets bombed, you know, every other summer, it might sound like a jarring disconnect. Why is music so important within a context in which people are being killed in wars, are being occupied and repressed in the West Bank, even inside Israel, of course, Arab Israelis facing their own repression in the Palestinian refugee camps, horrible conditions. Why is a focus on music a constructive thing?
Yeah. Well, it's a very good question, and it's one that Ramzi has asked himself. And a lot of the people, you know, when he brought, like the Pied Piper, he is all these French musicians to begin to explore the idea of a music camp, they debated themselves this very question. There's a couple of answers to that. One is, during the Second Intifada, which was much more violent and much more loss of life, which began in late December 2000 when Ariel Sharon made this provocative visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound and where the Temple of the Mount also is, he really didn't know whether it made sense for him to continue this dream. So one time, a couple of years later, when the Second Intifada was still raging, he made a visit to a school for of rehabilitation in Al-Amri refugee camp. And when he went and played the bouzouk, he also plays the Arabic bouzouk, and the kids were gathering around, and he noticed that on the walls and on the floor, the butcher paper, they were drawing pictures of tanks with orange fire exploding, mothers crying. And he thought, you know, when I'm in France, I see, you know, kids, when I visit a school, drawing sun and moon and stars and houses, kids draw what they see. And he left and came back a week later, and suddenly the kids were all gathering around him, and he saw that what they were drawing was musical instruments. Mm. And that was the moment that he made a commitment. And he's told me, and anybody who'll listen, many times, I want this music to protect these children from the soldiers.
Right.
Now that sounds sort of like a soundbite in a way, but if you look at the research that's been done in war zones in South Africa under apartheid, Northern Ireland during the Troubles, Bosnia, the idea that music can actually transform the way that children see themselves and make them feel stronger and give them a different identity is really important. But there's one other thing that's important to mention. Ramzi and Al-Kamajati, which means the violinist in Arabic.
And that's the name of his school.
The schools that he started. They use music as a way to confront the occupation. So, I mean, one of the most amazing things I witnessed was at the checkpoint, the Kalandia checkpoint that divides Israel, divides Jerusalem from Ramallah. There, it's just one of the most depressing places on earth. It's a huge, just fences and cattle chute guardrails and gun turrets. And these kids did what I would call, I called Operation Mozart. They did a peaceful guerrilla assault with music and set up their orchestra, their music stands, right in front of the soldiers at this checkpoint and played Mozart. It was a way of basically saying, we are here, we are reclaiming this space, we belong here, and we are putting the occupation into the public light.
Mm. Now, the late and great Edward Said also figures into this story. And when we talk about music and art in general as a form of resistance, this was something that he also deeply espoused and was just a great believer in the power of music. Can you tell us a little bit more about his role in this story?
Yes. Well, he, you know, as you well know, Sonali was a great champion of Palestinian rights from his post at Columbia and also a professor of comparative literature, author of Orientalism and many other well-respected books, but probably best known as a fierce defender of Palestinian rights. And he became very frustrated with Oslo. If you look at the growth of the settlements, not including the West Bank, I mean, not including East Jerusalem, the West Bank itself, outside of East Jerusalem, the population at the beginning of Oslo of Jewish settlers was 109,000. Today it's more than 350,000. This is during the so-called peace process. Edward early on saw this and became very disillusioned by it, and yet he wanted to find some sort of alternative model. By chance, he met the Israeli composer, Argentine-born classical music genius Daniel Barenboim. They struck up a very deep friendship that Barenboim himself says that they were intellectual soulmates, he told me. And they spoke every day until Edward died in 2003. And it was from this ferment of their friendship that they founded together the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. Now, the Divan doesn't enjoy the same sort of universal love that it had when Edward was alive and when they founded it, partly because the landscape of so-called dialogue under Oslo has really shifted to much more direct nonviolent confrontation represented by the BDS movement and by the Palestinians' effort at statehood. But back in this day, it was Edward's idea that we can create an alternative that can be an example. And it was this orchestra that Ramzi was invited to join and eventually did after Edward's birth, after Edward's death in 2003.
Right. So what do these music schools look like, and how have they transformed children? Because you know when you think about the terrible life facing some of these children, from a Western perspective, it might be more important to give them food and water and aid, which of course they need to survive. Mm-hmm. But it's those other things in life that make life worth living more than just eat food and survival.
Right.
And so, of course, music and art and these sorts of things that we feel we have privilege enough to enjoy here in mm-hmm. the Western world can make just such a huge difference. So what mm-hmm. sort of difference has it made in the lives of young children?
Well, I'd say by and large, I mean, not to say that there's not poverty in Palestine. Of course, there is. But lack of food and water isn't high on the list.
I mean, and Israel actually measures very carefully the caloric intake of right. Palestinians and mm-hmm. makes sure that people have just enough to survive.
Right, especially in Gaza.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not talking so much about Gaza, but
right.
the West Bank. I took six trips for this book. But really what people need more than anything is freedom. The lack of freedom of movement in yeah. Palestine, in the West Bank, for example, I mean, there are something like 600 checkpoints, barriers, roadblocks, other physical barriers in a land that's smaller than the U.S. state of Delaware, which mm. is the second smallest state. So what this music school does is it provides these children with a sense of freedom within the confines that they're living in, and as a way to symbolically confront the occupation. This actually changes their own view of themselves. One of the people I focused on in this book, who's the older sister of the girl on the cover, whose name is Ala Shalalda, Rasha, her older sister, played the flute. And she told me that when she began to play, it wasn't as though the occupation disappeared, but she began to be able to contend with it and see herself in a totally different way. She said, when I play, it's like I'm alone in a forest surrounded by a beautiful lake. I feel free. Now, of course, that doesn't suffice for actual freedom, but it gives these children a sense of dignity and pride that helps them contend with their lives in a more constructive way, and it helps them also become people who could be leaders later and in confronting the occupation itself.
What are the daily indignities that face Palestinian musicians like Ramzi Abu Redwan? In your book, you have a sort of running story that you break your chapters up with of what musicians have to do when they need to get to a concert and an Israeli soldier on a whim decides not to let them pass a checkpoint.
Yeah, it's you really can't understand the feeling of it until you experience it, although hopefully I'm able to do some of that in this book. But the checkpoint is the ubiquitous unavoidable reality of Palestinians. Their lands in the West Bank have been shattered into a kind of archipelago of islands within a sea of Israeli military control. When I first started going there, you know, you could actually drive for quite a while without seeing evidence of the occupation. Now you can't drive for 1 minute, literally. I've actually played this little game with myself when I drive around. Can you actually drive for 1 minute without seeing evidence of a soldier, a patrol, military base, settlement? You can't.
Wow.
So, and checkpoints are ubiquitous. There are these things called flying checkpoints that are set up suddenly. These kids, I mean, one of the stories I tell in the book is Alaa, the young violinist at age 10 in 2008, is forced to step out of the van. They're coming back from a concert in Bethlehem. And the soldier says, "What's in that case?" And she says, "It's a violin." He said, "Do you know how to play?" She said, "Yes." He says, "Play." And her sister, Rasha, yells, "Don't play for him." And she ends up playing this very powerful song called El Hawadi, which means the beautiful girl in Arabic. And, you know, it's something that gave her a sense of pride and dignity, even under such humiliating circumstances. But those circumstances shouldn't be there to begin with. This is the daily reality. I mean, another story is Ramzi's wife, Celine, who is Lebanese by birth and grew up also in France. She was at home with her six-month-old baby. Ramzi was off. He often goes to Europe to raise money for the school and to make a living as a musician. He was actually playing for the Queen of Holland. And Celine was home alone with their baby Hussein, and she hears somebody at the door in the middle of the night, and she opens, she goes and sees the door is getting forced open. She thinks it's a burglar, and she tells them to go away. And it turns out she looks through the little crack in the door, and there's 10 soldiers. And they said, "Step away," and they break down the door and point their guns at her. This is in a supposedly autonomous zone in Ramallah. It's autonomous except for when the Israeli military decides that it's not and notifies the Palestinian Authority, and they come in. So they burst in there, pointing their guns at her. Turns out they were looking for someone else, and they apparently broke three doors down that night. And when I ask people about this, the thing that's most amazing, Sonali, and you ask Alaa about, you know, playing at a checkpoint or being stopped at checkpoints all the time, they just go, "Oh, it's normal."
Yeah.
I mean, these kids, that's what they know.
That's what they know. And, you know, I you've made many documentaries for NPR and PRI about this conflict, and you know how biased coverage in the media can often arise from giving so-called balanced perspective on this very unbalanced fight.
Right.
Have your own thoughts on this issue evolved as you've spent more time witnessing what Palestinians face every day?
They have. They have. In fact, I mean, I think one of the things that's clear, especially with the growth of the settlements and what a lot of people call settler colonialism. I mean, it is an attempt to basically take the land, and it's been unfortunately largely successful, starting with Ariel Sharon, continuing with Benjamin Netanyahu, but not exclusively members of the Likud and of that sort of political bent. I mean, as I've seen what occupation does to people, to ordinary people, to children, to regular adults, how it stifles their aspirations that you and I just take for granted, the freedom that we have, just freedom of movement in this country. They have the right to freedom, and it's being suppressed. And to me, what's amazing is that, you know, when you talk about press coverage, there are many fine exceptions. Look, for example, at the work of Ben Hubbard from the New York Times in Gaza last summer. It's a shining example of how great journalism still does happen in the mainstream. However, it's amazing to me how far off the map Palestinian lives are. You know, Palestinian lives matter too. And how far off the map the daily life and indignities that Palestinians have to suffer, like, unless we understand what that is, I don't see how we get to a point of arrival where you say, this is unacceptable, this can't abide, we actually have to end the occupation.
Finally, I started our conversation talking about the musical and cultural boycott of Israel as part of the BDS movement. Do you see some interesting parallels here in depriving the occupier of music and art and supplying the occupied with music and art?
Well, I hadn't actually thought about that until your question. It is interesting. I mean, the boycott movement, you know, I hesitate to compare it to in volume at this point to the successful apartheid boycott movement, but there have been notable successes in terms of, for example, forcing Scarlett Johansson to step down as the spokesperson for SodaStream because they build a lot of their equipment in occupied territory. Stephen Hawking's declining to go to Israel. Lauryn Hill, you mentioned earlier, there and Veolia, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, the infrastructure builder of infrastructure all over the world. There were Boston area boycotters who basically kept it from a $4 billion contract. So you're beginning to see some economic impact. Whether this, together with a cultural boycott, will end up you know, being enough to force Israel to change its policies, to end the occupation, and begin to look at what people should be looking at now, which is equal rights within what has become a single state, some with rights, some without. Whether it, how long it will take before that becomes successful, it's hard to say. But it's true that there has been a lot of progress.
Sandy Tolan, best of luck to you, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Good to be here.
My guest, Sandy Tolan, is a radio documentary producer who has created dozens of pieces for NPR and PRI, co-founder of Homelands Productions, author of The Lemon Tree and Hank and Me, currently an associate professor at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. His new book we've been discussing is called Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land. This is Uprising.